Hello, I'm Preston Schleinkofer. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. Civil defense is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disasters might affect you and your community. This week, we're speaking with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He is the Executive Director of the EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security, which is a 501c3 nonprofit and a congressional advisory board dedicated to achieving protection of the United States from electromagnetic pulse, EMP, cyber attack, mass destruction terrorism, and other threats to civilian critical infrastructure on an accelerated basis. Dr. Pry was also director of the United States Nuclear Strategy Forum, an advisory board to Congress on policies to counter weapons of mass destruction. And this is part two of our two-part episode. And I want to give a shout out to Dr. Pry and his new book, The Power and the Light, The Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America, 2001 to 2020. And so it's our honor again to have Dr. Pry on Civil Defense Radio. Welcome, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, it truly is a pleasure. And just to be fully transparent, I am the Eastern Regional Director for the EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security. I'm affiliated with Dr. Pry and his organization. It is a pleasure to be a part of that. Now, Dr. Pry, this has come up a lot of times with people responding to posts that I make. They consider the old Soviet threat of ICBM going back and forth between them and us, and they think that that threat is gone. We don't have to worry about it anymore because our technology will see the missile launch before it gets to outer space. We'll knock it down, and then we'll retaliate or whatever other action we'll do. But what they don't realize is military strategy and capability has increased exponentially since those old Soviet threat days. And we have new things like Club K and missiles able to be launched off of a freighter anywhere there's water. There's so many things out there, cyber, physical attack, which we've had both here in the United States and abroad. So can you dispel this myth of that old threat versus the new threat? But before we do that, I want to give the audience a couple references here, and I'm going to put the links to these articles in the show notes. So we have a May 2020 article by you called "Iran's Satellite is No Tumbling Webcam." We have that was Newsmax, and then the Hill article is from April 27th, 2020, How to Lose a War Without Firing a Shot, Ignorance of Our Enemies' Arms Control Violations. And then we have Iran launched a military satellite, a nuclear device could be devastating. That's a Newsmax article from April 26, 2020. And then this one here was really great. I chuckled reading this because I could hear your voice in this. And it's April 22nd, 2020, Newsmax article titled "Why Arms Control Remains Delusional." So can you tie all that into your possibly your last EMP commission report from July 2017 titled "Nuclear EMP Attack Scenarios and Combined Arms Cyber Warfare"?
Well, sure. There's a lot in your question, and it has many layers. But let me start off by addressing the first issue that you raised, which I agree with you is a commonplace misconception that because mutual assured destruction supposedly worked and deterred the Soviet Union from starting a nuclear war during the Cold War, that it will work today, so we don't have to worry about an EMP attack from North Korea or Iran or from Russia or China. You know, that's the first idea, that assured destruction, mutual assured destruction will work. Well, first of all, people have a misconception about how well mutual assured destruction supposedly worked during the Cold War. I've written a book about this, called War Scare, Russia and America and the Nuclear Brink. And there have been actually many books written about the Cold War period that if people got educated about it, I had the opportunity to have a front row seat to how well the strategic balance, the mutual assured destruction supposedly worked during the Cold War, because it was at the CIA when the USSR was at the height of its power and then declined into Russia. And most people think that during the Cold War, we only had one nuclear close call, the Cuban Missile Crisis, but that isn't true. Every 18 months to 2 years, there was a crisis, and we came close to going over the edge into a thermonuclear conflict many times. If people really knew how poorly mutual assured destruction worked, that they wouldn't want to stake the lives of their grandchildren and children on it, because it's doomed to fail someday. The reason we didn't get in a thermonuclear war with the Soviet Union is because we got very lucky. You know, somebody once said, God loves fools, little children in the United States of America. And that is true. If you look at the history of that Cold War, it's really miraculous that we managed to get through it without stumbling into a nuclear conflict. And we won it, too, without firing a shot. And so maybe over a big picture, if you look at the largest, you know, but a lot of historians think, for example, that the only reason the Soviet Union didn't attack us is because Yuri Andropov died before he could launch World War III. And then they got a series of really old people in charge of the Politburo who were pretty incompetent until Gorbachev came along. And who was not a nuclear warrior of any kind. He actually had a naive faith that communism would work and that they could win peacefully the strategic competition. But that's another story. Also, just the idea that mutual assured destruction was ever mutual is completely false. You know, anybody who really understands what the Soviets were up to during the Cold War, that was an American fiction that we believed we wanted to convince them to follow a policy of mutual assured destruction so that we could control arms racing so it wouldn't cost us so much and maybe have a meeting of minds. But they were always using the arms control process to deceive us. They cheated on every one of the strategic arms control agreements to try to get advantage because they planned to win a nuclear war. And fortunately, you know, America was run by the greatest generation, the generation that won World War II and eventually won the Cold War. And they weren't naive about arms control. They remembered Hitler and Mussolini and Tojo. And so there was a consensus among the Democrat and Republicans to keep America's nuclear deterrent strong. So we didn't let them get that advantage that they were always seeking by hook or by crook. And that's what kept them from finally attacking us, including accidents like the fact that Andropov died. And as it happened, another illustration of how you can't rely on mutual assured destruction, because the risk of an accidental nuclear war is also possible. I think the single most dangerous moment in the nuclear missile age happened after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1995. And ironically, it happened under President Boris Yeltsin, who was the friendliest leader, who wanted to democratize Russia and was trying to be a friend of the United States. But on January 25th, 1995, he nearly pushed the button, you know, because the general staff, there was a clerical error over the launch of a Norwegian meteorological rocket that happened to come up out of the Barents Sea. And the Russian general staff thought this was a patrol area for our Ohio-class ballistic missile submarines. And the dimensions of this meteorological rocket, it's really a multi-stage missile, looked like a U.S. Trident sub-launch ballistic missile. And the Russian general staff thought that America was launching a surprise attack, that this was an EMP attack, and that we were going to try to paralyze their command and control, and then there would be a massive first strike by us just behind it. And the general staff was yelling at Yeltsin to push the button, you know, to preempt our surprise attack, to hit us before the mass strike came. And fortunately, here's just another case of God being on our side, you know, that was Yeltsin, who was the president, And he nearly did push the button. They activated their chegets. This is their equivalent of the presidential football, you know. And when the chegets are activated, just like when we activate our football, it isn't supposed to be a question of whether you're supposed to push the button. It's just a question is how big is the counterattack going to be, you know. But Yeltsin fortunately didn't push the button. He ignored the generals and waited. And then when it became clear this missile passed Apogee and it wasn't an EMP attack, I mean, this guy, the fate of the world depended upon this alcoholic, you know, doing the right thing at the right time against the advice of his own general staff and against what they had practiced in all of their strategic forces exercises. So that's what mutual assured destruction is like. That's how easily it can fail, and it will fail if we continue to rely upon it. So that's just my commentary on this misconception about how well things worked during the Cold War. In the aftermath now, we have options. The whole idea of deterrence will only work if you know who attacked you and if you're capable of retaliating. And that's one of the big attractions about EMP to the bad guys today, because the EMP can paralyze your retaliatory forces. If you've got a super EMP weapon, you know, and the North Koreans do, the Chinese do, the Russians do, Iran is a strategic partner with North Korea. Most of their missiles come from North Korea. You know, we don't know. It's entirely possible North Korea at some point might decide to give Iran a super EMP weapon. That weapon generates such powerful fields that even our hardened strategic forces and command and control would be paralyzed. You know, they're only hardened up to 50,000 volts per meter. I mean, I say only, you know, that's extremely significant, 50,000 volts per meter, right? That's the maximum EMP field you can get from a normal nuclear weapon of very high yield. But now there's this new kind of weapon that was invented basically and has been deployed in the aftermath of the Cold War called a super EMP weapon. It has a very low yield, but it puts out a lot of gamma rays, and it can generate extraordinarily powerful fields, much higher than 50,000 volts per meter, and which is the maximum hardness of Air Force One and of our Minuteman ICBMs and B-52s and the cruise missiles. And most of our military forces, our conventional forces, aren't hardened at all. So all that could be paralyzed. So mutual assured destruction doesn't work when you can't retaliate. And it also doesn't work when you don't know who hit you. You know, you can do a surprise EMP attack, as you had mentioned, I think, off a freighter. The Russians have marketed, and Iran, we know, has bought the Club K. This is a missile that's designed to be disguised. So you can turn any freighter into a missile launch platform. It's designed to fit inside of a shipping container, a normal shipping container, the kind of thing that is used to deliver furniture and food around the world. And so any freighter, you know, could be carrying a Club K missile. And this Club K will fly under radar, and then at the last minute could rocket up, you know, to high altitude to do an EMP attack and completely surprise you. And you wouldn't know where that missile came from, because there's thousands of freighters off of our coastal waters. It could be anybody who'd made the attack, including a terrorist group that managed to get their hands on a nuke. Iran has actually practiced launching a missile off of a freighter at sea. And, you know, the Shahab-3, which is one of their best missiles, a medium-range missile, is a mobile missile. It's a perfect thing that you could drive that into it onto a freighter and put it in the hold of a freighter, you know, and launch it. North Korea has had the SA-1. These are nuclear capable surface to air missiles. And back in 2013, I think it was July of 2013, during one of the worst nuclear crises we had with North Korea, they managed to sneak a freighter with two of these SA-1 air-to-air missiles. They weren't armed with nuclear weapons, but they're designed to take a 10-kiloton nuclear warhead. So they're the kind of thing that is perfect for doing a high-altitude EMP attack.
Now, what is the range of these missiles you're talking about? Some people might think, oh, they don't have the range to do anything, but they don't really need to get too close, right?
They don't. The range for the SA-1, I think, is about 100, 150 kilometers or something like that. So if you came in, you could stand outside of our 3-mile territorial limit, you know, and launched this and detonated over a coastal area. It detonated over Texas or Louisiana or Florida. You know, if you wanted to do a demonstration to us, you know, you could, like, just take out Texas, because the Texas grid is, it's the only state that has its own grid except for Hawaii, you know, and Alaska. If you wanted to take down America, you could do it over Florida, for example, or Louisiana, because those grids, those state grids, are tied into the big East Coast grid. And just because the EMP goes off, let's say on the coastal region, it's not going to be limited to the coastal region. It's the cascading effects of the blackout will go far beyond the EMP field itself. The EMP field will reach hundreds of kilometers inland from the altitude and the range of the SA-1, which, as I said, is 100, 150 kilometers. Okay, it's not nothing. It's nothing like an ICBM. But the issue, you could even use a meteorological balloon. A balloon could deliver a warhead, you know, someplace over the United States. And once you get that EMP field anywhere, especially over the East Coast, you know, it'll cause a cascading blackout that will take out the rest, that will take out the rest of the grid. And we should know this. Bad guys certainly know it, because we've had many cases where, well, for example, the Great Northeast Blackout of 2003, you know, which was caused by a tree branch coming in contact with a high voltage power line in Ohio. And it started a series of cascading failures. Okay, so the immediate damage to the grid was just that tree branch hitting one high voltage power line in Ohio, and this started a chain of cascading failures. The dominoes fell all through the northeastern United States. Even New York City was put into blackout for a day. 50 million Americans were in the dark for a day. Now, fortunately, it was just a tree branch. It wasn't a nuclear weapon, right? You know, but if we had a protracted blackout like that, if an EMP attack happened, it would black out at least the whole eastern grid if you put it over the east, anywhere over the eastern part of the United States, any place east of the Mississippi River, and because that whole grid is tied together, and that would doom us. I mean, that alone, even if the western grid remained up, that alone would take us out, because 75% of the country's electrical energy is generated by the eastern grid, and most of our population lives on the eastern grid.
Yeah.
And I would add, most of our nuclear reactors are also in the eastern grid, and those things will go Fukushima in 7 days and spread radioactivity everywhere. But so there's one way of doing it so that they don't know. You could do it by balloon. You could do it off a freighter. You could do you could launch something off a submarine. Not necessarily a sub-launched ballistic missile, but a cruise missile. You can do it by satellite. A lot of people, and the North Koreans have actually got two satellites orbiting over us now, the KMS-3 and KMS-4, at the perfect altitude for putting an EMP field over North America. Now, the EMP Commission doesn't know if those things are armed for a nuclear attack or not, but we are concerned that they may well be. Because of the trajectory of the satellites, the satellites are on a polar trajectory, so they fly from south to north, and that means that they basically elude our ballistic missile early warning radars and our national missile defenses. All of our ballistic missile early warning radars are facing out toward the north to look for an attack coming over the North Pole or off the east and west coasts of the United States for sub-launched ballistic missiles. But there's a big hole in our defenses to the south, and that satellite, both satellites, fly right through that hole. So we don't even see them coming. And there's hundreds of satellites in that low Earth orbit. You know, we wouldn't necessarily know that it was a North Korean satellite that did the EMP attack if it went off. Because one of the first things that goes is our national technical means. You know, our satellite ground stations, our radar stations, all the things that we need to say, well, what satellite was that? Whose satellite made that attack? You know, those things go blind when you get an EMP attack. Mm. So EMP is a perfect kind of weapon for achieving a surprise attack that would paralyze your retaliatory capabilities, and for keeping your fingerprints off the attack so that you could get away with it potentially. And so that's a big change in the situation that existed in the past. I would also point out that a lot of people think that our national missile defenses can shoot down, you know, our adversaries, ICBMs and the like. But that's not true. The national missile defenses really aren't very good. We aren't, even though they were built during the Bush administration, we basically have inherited the Clinton administration's idea of what a national missile defense should be. And the Clinton administrations didn't want to upset mutual assured destruction with Russia or China. They didn't want the Russians or Chinese to think that we were building national missile defenses to deter their ability to threaten our population. Okay? So we deliberately designed the national missile defense interceptors so that they aren't effective at intercepting more sophisticated missiles, such as the Russians and Chinese deploy. And now it turns out that they're really not very capable against the North Korean missiles either, because the North Korean missile program and their nuclear program has been helped by Russia and China. So the North Korean missiles are a lot more sophisticated than we expected they were going to be. And that's why it would take multiple shots from the National Missile Defense to have high confidence of taking down just one North Korean missile if they decided to do an EMP attack or tried to nuke them in an American city by launching an ICBM. And that is the least likely way that they'd make an EMP attack anyway, you know, because we would see the missile coming off of their national territory. It's much more likely that they would start an attack by satellite or by launching something off a freighter or off a submarine or something where their fingerprints wouldn't be on it. And then once we're blind and defenseless, then they could launch their land-based missiles and finish the job if the job needed to be finished. You know, the job just from the EMP alone, you know, 90% of Americans could be killed in a year, and part of the from starvation, disease, and societal collapse, and part of the calculus of this new way of warfare, and it is a new way of warfare that didn't exist during the Cold War, I would add. That's one of the most important messages of the EMP Commission report you referred to earlier, nuclear EMP attack scenarios and combined armed cyber warfare. Important title, because Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, in their military doctrines, they all talk about this revolutionary new way of warfare where you can defeat an adversary like the United States without having to do battle with our military forces, without having to confront the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, or the Marines. And the idea is to attack our electric grid with a combination of cyber attacks, physical sabotage, small numbers of special forces running around the country, shooting up transformers and shooting up control centers. And the ultimate, the big stick, is an EMP attack. And they would also use non-nuclear EMP weapons, too. But the big stick is that nuclear EMP attack, because it is the most effective guarantor of taking down that grid. You could actually take the grid down with any one of these things by itself. Cyber attack could take down the grid by itself. Sabotage could take the grid down by itself. Non-nuclear EMP weapons could take the grid down by itself. Or an EMP attack, nuclear EMP attack, would certainly take the grid down by itself. But imagine when you combine these options, these attack vectors all together, it guarantees you're going to succeed. And the attack becomes irresistible. And when you go to kill the emperors, there's an old saying, if you try to kill the emperor, you must succeed. And if you're North Korea or Iran and you want to kill the emperor of the United States, well, you're going to throw in the kitchen sink to make sure that happens. And right now, you know, we have so neglected our defenses. The idea of this new way of warfare is so new to us, and even now is really not appreciated by the big brains in Washington. You know, they need to read the EMP Commission reports better. But they are starting to catch up. You know, the presidential executive orders to start the process of protecting our electric grid, you know, is a sea change in the way Washington thinks. You know, only in the last, well, since 2019, really, when President Trump passed that first executive order to protect the grid against EMP, finally, after 20 years of warnings from the EMP Commission and other strategists and intelligence experts, finally, after 20 years, a president has listened, a White House has listened, and we're starting to move in the right direction. But the bad guys have been thinking about this for decades and planning for this for decades, so we're way behind the curve. The situation, to my mind, is very much like 1939, You know, when Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan had come up with revolutionary ways of warfare that were not understood in the West, except for maybe a handful of strategic thinkers who got ignored, like Winston Churchill and Major General J.F.C. Fuller. I mean, Churchill and Fuller understood the German Blitzkrieg, you know, at least they understood it better than most other people. Even Churchill was surprised at how quickly France was overrun when it finally happened. But he was doing everything he could to warn about, you know, the buildup of German tanks, the air force, the idea of using armor and air power and mobile infantry in combination would be an irresistible new way of warfare that would make obsolete the trench warfare of World War I and give quick victory, a lightning victory, which is what Blitzkrieg means, to adversaries. And Neville Chamberlain and most of the Western intelligentsia, 99% of them thought Churchill was crazy and ignored him. And it gave us World War II in Europe, which the Nazis almost won because of this new revolution in military affairs. And on the Japanese side, Americans wouldn't listen to Billy Mitchell, you know, the pioneer of naval aviation, who said aircraft carriers, not battleships, are the wave of the future. The bad guys are going to use aircraft carriers, not just for scouting, but it's going to be the major offensive weapon in a future war. The aircraft carriers will be able to sink your battleships and win decisively. And he got court-martialed for that. And Mitchell was ignored, and then we got rewarded with Pearl Harbor. We paid the price for that. Thank God the aircraft carriers weren't in Pearl Harbor. If they were, we probably would have lost the Pacific War. But I think we're in a similar situation today. It's that bad, where it's not just our lack of physical and the technological preparedness, but there's the most dangerous part of this is there's still this failure of strategic imagination, where our elites in Washington still don't get this new way of warfare that all the bad guys have been planning to spring on us.
Yeah, that's one of the things that confounds me. And when I first started learning about EMP and that threat and everything else along the way, it was unbelievable that our political leaders and even the military, which I'm retired after 22 years, and I spent 12 years in nuclear, biological, chemical defense. And I learned basically nothing about EMP during that time. And it seems like we always have this problem of trying to fight tomorrow's battles based on yesterday's victories. And, you know, we need to think out of the box, because that's what our adversaries are doing. That's what the terrorists did in 9/11. They thought out of the box. You know, who would have thought that aircraft would have been used as a weapon? But it was, or they were. And so it's amazing that this lack of creativity and understanding and forward thinking is so void when it comes to the people that should be using these ideas and concepts and listening to experts such as yourself.
Yeah, it's an enormous frustration to me that you think of all the people in the Department of Defense, in the Department of Homeland Security, okay, and all the think tanks in Washington that are charged, you know, with providing for our national security, hundreds of thousands of people who are supposed to be, you know, thinking about this stuff and preparing for this stuff, and they get blindsided so often and taken by surprise so often. We always seem to be getting taken by surprise. We got taken by surprise in World War II. You know, we got taken by surprise during the Tet Offensive in the Vietnam War. We were taken by surprise in the Korean War too, and didn't see that coming. You know, 9/11, as you mentioned, and we're taken by surprise by the coronavirus today. I mean, thank God it wasn't a serious biological weapons attack. You know, we've spent somehow, and I think this is due to the corruption and incompetence of the system. You know, as a person in the military, I'm sure you knew. Now, EMP was deeply classified and up until the EMP Commission reports, which is why a lot of people hadn't heard of it. But biological warfare, it, the possibility of it was not classified. And we've known, you know, since the 50s and 60s that a bad guy could come at us with biological warfare. And we've spent, supposedly we had spent decades and billions of dollars preparing for serious biological warfare, like genetically engineered anthrax or smallpox that could have a mortality rate of 90% and would make the coronavirus look like nothing. And yet, when we get hit with this coronavirus, which is more of a psychological threat than a real threat, you know, look at the catastrophic consequences. It's panicked our elites into making rash decisions that I think they're starting to wake up to the fact that the cure is worse than the cold, as it were.
Yeah.
And the bad guys notice this. They notice this. I pondered often, why is it that our institutions are so constantly being taken by surprise? And I have a theory about that. For one thing, I think there's a big difference in strategic culture between free democratic systems and totalitarian and authoritarian systems. You know, totalitarian yeah. states and authoritarian states, they know that their power comes out of the barrel of a gun, okay? You know, they're not constrained by Judeo-Christian values when it comes to thinking about fighting. And in fact, their creativity, for them, you know, what they do best is prepare for wars and fight wars. And that's what they do. And you can even see them celebrate it because they, all of these countries, Iran, North Korea, Russia, and China, you know, love to parade their missiles through the streets. And people, you know, get off on the fact that they their nuclear strength is so great. Free countries, you know, with our roots in Judeo-Christian values, Our creativity doesn't go into thinking about new ways of winning World War III. Yeah, we have good technicians and good scientists making weapon systems, but having a good cruise missile isn't the same thing as really having a well-thought-out war plan and new strategy in terms of how do you use and combine all these things into a real killer, you know, that will clinch World War III for you. And, you know, most of our creativity goes into, well, you know, making life better, educating our children, the arts and the positive sciences, you know, extending people's lives, making a better burger and pizza, you know. I mean, that's where our creativity and our wealth yeah. gets poured. And maybe rightly so. I mean, that's what the people want. And also societies which are, where the legitimacy of the society is based on the will of the people, and this is also rooted in our Judeo-Christian values, weapons of mass destruction or military strategies that could put 90% of the population at risk, you know, we don't like to think about those things. Those things are antithetical to our values because the legitimacy of our society yes. is based on the masses of people, on the people. And so a weapon that threatens the existence of the people is antithetical to our most fundamental values. Whereas on the other hand, if you look at our adversaries, you know, which are based on totalitarian states and totalitarian ideologies where the people are expendable, you know, to serve the purposes of those elites or the purposes of those radical totalitarian ideologies, you know, they love the idea of being able to engage in the mass extermination of their opponents, and they celebrate it. So there's an enormous gap here, and that's part of the problem, a difference in the strategic cultures that makes us hold back so that it's very hard. I mean, just look at how we've allowed our nuclear triad to obsolete. You know, it's on the verge of obsolescence, I mean, it's so critical to our survival, but we hate it so much. The average American hates the idea of even having nuclear weapons so much that we've allowed it to deteriorate to the point where we're putting ourselves at risk. The other factor, I think, that accounts for the failure of strategic imagination is and this is kind of ironic, you know. In the cultures of the bad guys, I think, you know, they love warfare so much, or the idea of being able to destroy your adversary so much, that their military thinkers are almost like artists, you know? And so The individual, the brilliant individual, you know, can rise to the top and be listened to because the general staff wants to hear these good ideas. And, the father of this new way of warfare is a guy named General Vladimir Slepchenko, who wrote a book called No Contact Wars, sort of like the way Rommel wrote Achtung Armor, which was one of the bases for the Blitzkrieg, okay? And the Nazis listened to him, and all the bad guys, including the Chinese and the North Koreans, each of them claims to have their own, you know, genius that it came up with it on their own. For example, the Chinese have Shen Wei Guan, who has written a book on total information warfare, and they claim he invented this new way of warfare. Okay, so the Chinese and Russians kind of, but Slepchenko published first. And the Iranians, interestingly, in their military textbook, you know, that advocates this new way of warfare, they actually on the front page tip their hat and pay tribute to the great General Slepchenko for coming up with this idea, which that ought to send alarm bells in Washington. I mean, why don't people pay attention to that the Russians and Iranians are working together so closely that an Iranian military textbook, you know, is honoring a Russian general for helping them with this idea of using an EMP attack to take out the United States. But anyway, kind of a side thing, in our system, the Billy Mitchells can get court-martialed, you know, or they get ignored and beaten down. And we have a real problem with, when it comes to our centers of creativity for the technologies of peace, this principle of listening to the genius, the independent genius, does prevail. You know, we have our Elon Musks and people like that in the private sector. But as you know, having worked in our armed services, maybe it's less so there. I know from my experience in the intelligence community, and the intelligence community is supposed to be our tip of the spear. The intelligence community is supposed to be our warning system against these kinds of developments, right? But they don't see it because the way our intelligence community works is by corporate opinion. You know, you can't, as a former CIA analyst, for example, I wasn't, and this has always been the case, and it is the case today. You know, you can't sit down and write a report, a CIA report that has your name on it, and then send that out to warn everybody. That's not how it works. You can write a report, but then the report has to be agreed upon by everybody, basically. And as a consequence, you know, the views of that gifted individual get watered down by all the mediocrities who don't have as good an understanding. And our intelligence community, just like every organization, it's got some really, it's got a lot more mediocre people than there are brilliant people. And it's got at least as many stupid people as it has gifted people, okay? And when you add that all up, all right, what you end up with on balance is mediocrity in terms of the judgments. And that's one of the failures, one of the things that we have in our system because of this idea of speaking with one voice and having a corporate view dominate the way things are done. That's why our intelligence community is constantly behind the curve and failing, I believe. And so these two factors and the differences in the strategic cultures, you know, whereas the bad guys, their greatest creativity is in planning for war and preparing for war, and that's not our strong suit intellectually. And then the fact that on the other, the bad guys, in their strategic culture, they relish the artist, as it were, the person who comes up with that new idea.
We're over my time limit, but I didn't want to stop you because you were on a roll and I wanted to get all that on tape. But it's been a pleasure having you these past two episodes, and I thank you very much for your time. And civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation you may find yourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. Be sure to check out our regular postings on our Facebook page at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at civil_def_radio and on YouTube at Civil Defense Radio Podcast, where we post these episodes as well as other information that we find about the threats we see about the safety and security of a nation. I wish to thank Dr. Pry again for being on the show these last two episodes, and I want to thank you, our friends and listeners, who are with us on a regular basis. I really appreciate you being with us. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.